This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
So I'm here with Professor Richard Bauer from the University of Durham. And, well, first of all, I'd like to welcome you back to the Jodcast, because I see that Indy interviewed you for our NAM special way back in 2014.
That's great. It's a pleasure to be back.
Just to reintroduce you to our listeners, you are a Professor of Cosmology at the University of Durham at the Centre for Extragalactic Astronomy and Institute for Computational Cosmology. And you research both observational and theoretical cosmology, right?
When I did my PhD, I had two supervisors, one in observational astronomy and one in theoretical cosmology. And they both expected me to work 75% of the time on their project. And I've always tried to carry that on. You know, as my career's gone on, I found some things more interesting than others, and the balance has shifted from time to time. But I think it's very important that observers understand the theory that they're trying to test, and that theorists understand the limitations of observation. So I've always tried to keep a foot in both sides of the camp.
So in terms of what you work on, what is it that your research is based around? What's your background and what are you currently working on?
So overall, what I'm trying to do is to understand the universe. But within that, my speciality is to try and understand how the universe goes from the initial conditions that we measure with the Planck satellite in exquisite detail, to understand how the universe creates the galaxies that we see today. So one of the things that's always fascinated me is the way we live in a spiral galaxy. Why are there spiral galaxies? Why are other galaxies elliptical? Why does our galaxy form stars? Galaxies that are a little bit more massive seem to be largely devoid of star formation. And so towards the beginning of my career, that was largely an observational question. There were just some very simple analytic theories, and it needed to be driven by getting better data, measuring the colors and the star formation rates of galaxies, introducing the idea of galaxy ecology, you know, how galaxies are affected by their environments and their associations with one another. Now we have these huge surveys, these very large data sets. We know a lot about the properties of galaxies in great, great detail, even their internal properties of galaxies in the local universe. But we also know a lot about galaxies when the universe was much younger, at redshift 1, at redshift 2, when the universe was only a few billion years old. Now my interests are more to try and understand that observational data by making models of the universe and trying to understand what is the physics that drives the changes in galaxy properties with cosmic time.
So how is it that you go about modelling the universe? You said that so simply, but it seems like it would be quite a big task to undertake, modelling the entirety of the universe.
It's not that hard, right?
Okay.
The basic aim is that you take the laws of physics, and we know those from Newton. We need slightly better versions from Einstein to understand the expanding universe. But then we basically program that into a computer and then let the computer evolve. Now, this used to be an almost impossible task because we didn't know very much about how the universe began. And that sort of very much limited what we could do. But now with the exquisite data on the cosmic microwave background, we know a lot about how the universe looked at redshift 1000 when it was 300,000 years old. And so we can use those to initialize the computer calculation, and then we can propagate that forward in time by applying the laws of physics. The hard part is actually understanding how stars and black holes form, and how forming stars that then explode as supernova affect the formation of more stars, and similarly with black holes. And that's proved the trickiest part of the universe to understand.
So it seems like you've got to take a lot of things into account. In terms of computational time and computational power that's involved in doing this, I mean, what kind of levels of computing are we talking about here?
The calculation that I'll talk about today is the Eagle calculation of the universe, and the largest calculation we ran took a month and a half on 4,000 compute cores on the Dirac supercomputer system. We're very fortunate to have access to this top-class UK facility, and we were able to organise access to a large fraction of the computer, two-thirds of the computer, which made it possible to run a calculation that many people thought would be impossible. And we were able to do that. And because we spent a long time developing the way we incorporated the physics of star formation, black holes, when we ran this calculation, we were able to reproduce the observed properties of today's universe in remarkable detail. And it's proved an incredible resource, both for theorists, but also for observational astronomers, because you can go into this simulation, you can find a galaxy that looks like one you've observed with a telescope, find something similar in the simulation. But the beauty of the simulation is you can then press a button, and time will run backwards, and you can see how that galaxy was created, and very much understand then the physics of things that you observe in the universe.
So what are the main things that you've learned from doing these simulations? Have there been any kind of key results? Is there anything that surprised you from it at all?
One of the most incredible results was the way that we were able to explain the transition mass in galaxies. So it's long been seen, if you take a big data set like the Sloan survey, that galaxies below a galaxy of about the mass of the Milky Way are largely forming stars and have been building up their mass. They double their mass on about timescale of the age of the universe. But if you go to larger galaxies, these are very much, star formation is much weaker in those systems, and they're hardly going to grow in mass by star formation in the future of the universe. And one of the great things about the simulation is when we put in the physics, we made this discovery that the simulation did and reproduced this result seen in the real universe. And we then did a lot of investigation to try and understand why. Another beautiful thing about simulations is they're like experiments. So we can experiment with the universe. We can switch things off, turn things on. And the remarkable result we found is that this transition mass is due to black holes. So black holes don't grow very efficiently in galaxies less massive than the Milky Way. They're starved of material by star formation. But as galaxies get larger, star formation is less efficient at blowing material and keeping it away from the black hole. Suddenly the black hole grows and heats up the surrounding of the galaxy so that it can gain very little further fuel for forming new stars. So this has been a remarkable result. It's amazingly robust in the simulations. And has given us much greater insight into how the universe is shaped and the diversity of galaxy morphologies as well as their star formation rates comes about.
So you mentioned rewinding the clock basically and looking back in time and using your simulation to do that. Have you wound the simulation forward in time? Can it tell you anything about how the universe is going to evolve?
So this is a very interesting question, and clearly one of the things we're very excited to work on now is what happens to the future of the universe. And to take the simulation and run it forward in time and measure what fraction of stars have formed in the universe so far compared to what will form in the future. And an interesting question is how much of this is due to the presence of black holes in the calculation, and what would happen if we were to remove black holes from the calculation?
That seems quite a pretty fundamental thing, right? Just removing black holes completely.
Exactly. I one of the things I found fascinating in doing this work is how important black holes are in shaping the structure of the universe. And I can remember going to conferences and people saying, how can something as small as a black hole affect their surroundings, the galaxy they're in even? And yet, it seems to be true that the future of the universe, the history of the universe, is shaped by the presence of black holes. And I find this really interesting that you might have thought that it would be Einstein's cosmological constant would dominate the future of the universe. But actually, it turns out to be the other aspect of Einstein's gravity. It's the creation of black holes that determines the future of the universe. It's very interesting.
Cool. So is it just that simulation that you're working on, and do you have other areas of research within cosmology as well?
So one of the things I'm heavily involved in at the moment is to measure the angular momenta of galaxies. So this is on the observational side. We built in Durham was the lead institution for the KMOS spectrograph at ESO. And that gave us an opportunity to build a large sample of galaxies in the distant universe where we have measured the rotation speeds of those galaxies, we've measured the sizes, we've measured a lot about the structure of those galaxies. And hence we're able to study how the angular momentum of galaxies evolves with time. And this is very interesting because I think we can use this to understand how the Hubble sequence emerges. That early in the history of the universe, galaxies have relatively little angular momentum. They have a lot of gas. This makes the galaxies incredibly unstable. But as time passes, the angular momentum of the material accreted by galaxies increases. They get more diffuse, the gas densities go down, and the star formation rates go down, probably because the increased angular momentum makes the galaxies more stable. And so we see this in the simulations, but we also see this in the real universe. And we're trying at the moment to put these two things together, the simulated measurements and the simulations and what they predict versus what we actually see in the universe for the evolution of galaxies.
So when you're pointing a telescope at these galaxies, how do you go from those observations to, well, understanding aspects of their angular momentum, as you were saying? What kind of techniques are involved in determining that?
So we have sophisticated ways of taking the observations of the galaxy. Now, one of the really good things about the KMOS spectrograph is that it's an integral field unit, and it's in fact 24 integral field units all running at...
I must admit, I don't know what an integral field unit is, if you wouldn't mind explaining what
one of those is. Let me explain that. So normally you would, in astronomy, take a picture of a galaxy, and that would be very nice, and you could see some of its structure. And then you might decide to measure its redshift, and you would take a spectrum of the galaxy by taking as much of the light of the galaxy as you could and making a single spectrum. And from that, you could see an emission line and measure the redshift of the galaxy. But the integral field unit combines both of those things. So at every pixel in the image, you obtain a spectrum. So you now have a three-dimensional data set which lets you measure for every point on the galaxy what is the movement of gas at that particular radius. And so from this you can then reconstruct the three-dimensional model of the galaxy directly from that three-dimensional data. So this lets you understand the structures of the galaxies, where the stars are being formed, what the rotation speeds are, but how the rotation speed varies across the galaxy. And you know an awful lot of detail, which is quite amazing for galaxies when the universe was only a few billion years old.
So that all sounds incredibly exciting and interesting. What is going to be the next major step in this research, be it theoretical or observational?
What I'm focused on at the moment is trying to simulate a much bigger universe. So although we achieved a lot with this Eagle calculation, we're still limited by the fact that we only have a little patch of the universe. It's about representative enough as the universe as a whole, but it doesn't include many of the rare objects that astronomers like to study because they're particularly bright and easy to measure properties of. It would be great to be able to produce a universe which is 10, 30 times bigger. So our aim at the moment is to be able to do that. Now, one of the problems is trying to get 30 times more computing power. That is going to be really hard. So what we've been focused on is trying to understand how to use computers better. And in particular, the architecture of computers has changed relatively recently, the structure, the way they can communicate. And so we're building a new simulation code called Swift, which will let us exploit these modern features of computer architectures much more effectively. So we think from this we can achieve a factor of 10 increase in speed. So with access to computers that are 3 times bigger, we can be simulating large patches of the universe which are comparable to observational surveys. And so that's our key next goal.
That all sounds very exciting. But I believe that's not the only thing that you work on, because last time you were on the Jodcast, you talked about a project that you're involved in called the Ordered Universe.
Yes.
So I was wondering if you could give us a little bit of a refresher on that and maybe any updates since then.
Yes, so let me give you a little bit of update on that. So the Ordered Universe project was a very interesting opportunity I had to work with historians and theologians, and they were studying work by Robert Grosseteste, who was a medieval bishop of Lincoln, one of the most important cathedrals in Britain. And as well as his religious work, which is very deeply respected, he wrote a set of scientific treatises trying to explain aspects of the world around him. And one of the important things about that is at the time there wasn't a division between religion and science, as close to science as was being done at the time. And it was very much seen that trying to understand the universe would bring you closer to God. And so Robert Grosseteste wrote a very interesting treatise called On Light, in which he tries to explain the origin of the universe. And one of the amazing things is the way he very much follows the same processes of deduction as we follow today. So we try to make laws of physics which explain the world around us, and then we apply those laws across all of space and time. And so Robert Grosseteste does this, and he sees light as being very important to the universe and being the reason why a universe made up of point-like particles is held together is by light. Turns out that's more or less true, and he applies his theory to try and explain the origin of the universe. And my involvement with that work is previously people had looked at this and tried to translate his Latin work into English, and it didn't really make any sense. But the team I was involved in started trying to translate it into mathematics. And as physicists, as we read this document, we were thinking, oh, this is describing the equation of continuity. Why don't we just write down the equation of continuity? And we found that by writing the work in terms of equations, we could create something that we could then actually make a computer simulation of. And amazingly, it was capable of explaining the universe as understood by Robert Grosseteste at the time. So at the time, it was viewed that the Earth was at the center, and then there were crystal spheres that surrounded the universe. But his model explains this very well, of how these spheres crystallize as a result of the interaction of matter and light. And so this has been very interesting work. It's had me working in a very different area, understanding how other disciplines work and how you try to understand historical documents. You very often have to understand words as they're used in their context of the time. So that's been a very, very interesting work and has led to significant improvement in the understanding of how people understood the medieval universe in medieval time. So now we're looking at other scientific documents. We have some very interesting work understanding how the planets were seen to move and trying to understand why that was such a compelling system to have the Earth at the center and the planets moving in orbits around the Earth. And it's all very interesting how much you can learn by applying mathematics to medieval documents.
So these works were all just done in terms of words. They didn't write any mathematics down themselves. Did they perform any mathematics?
Well, at the time, you could have had a very highly paid job by being able to do algebra, and you would more or less have appeared as a magician to work out calculations. the documents, though, are written in words because modern algebraic notation using symbols and letters for multiplication and division did not exist at the time, and everything was described in terms of words rather than equations of balances of words, wordy descriptions of mathematical formulae. So you can achieve a lot by trying to take the wordy description and go, oh, how would I write this as a modern day equation? And that is then very susceptible to analysis. I wonder how much Robert Grosseteste would have used geometry and geometrical construction to solve problems. And one of the interesting aspects is that to test my computer code and to make sure it ran correctly, I ended up having to derive a solution. And the way I derived that solution ended up being geometry. So it's quite possible Robert Grosseteste was able to solve some of these word equations by drawing figures and calculating the locations of tangents to spheres. I think it's given me a much deeper appreciation of what could be done in the medieval world. These documents were written in maybe 1224 or something like this, right? So when you see old documents and old buildings, don't underestimate the technical ability of people at the time. I mean, you look at Durham Cathedral, it's still standing up, right?
Well, exactly, yes, yeah. Is there anything else that you're working on? Any other side projects or
any other little side projects at the moment? Well, I think at the moment the greatest interest is to understand the universe and to do these simulations better. That's led us to doing a lot more in understanding how computer codes work. What we'd like to understand better is how to do computer simulations that cover a broad range of scales. One of the things that would be nice would be to embed real star formation into a computer simulation. And we know how to do simulations that would actually have the resolution to form star-forming clouds, and within those clouds to form stars. But it's inconceivable that you would ever have the computational power to do this across a huge patch of universe. But that doesn't mean it's impossible. If we knew how to couple simulations of different scales, how to work out which regions we needed to simulate anew and which regions were just like another patch of the universe, and so we could just transfer a result from one region to another. I think this is a very interesting scientific challenge that affects not just what we do, but a great many scientific disciplines. So that's going to be a focus for the future, to try and do that better, and I hope it will have profound implications outside astronomy as well.
Thank you very much for your time today.
Well, thank you, Emma, for having me and giving me a chance to talk about this.
You're very, very welcome.